All right, I've got a great show. I've got two guests today. They are both victims of sexual assault when they were younger. Sarah Snyder escaped a cult, and she talks about how she did that and how she's overcoming everything that she endured in the first 18 years of her life in that cult. And then joining us halfway through is Dawn Taylor. Dawn is a trauma specialist, and she is just awesome. You can find her at thetaylorway.ca or at seenheardhealed.com. She's an author, she's written a book, and she is now helping others get past their trauma, and she helped Sarah. And very interesting conversation I had with them, and very moving. They're very brave for telling their story, and our hope is that it can help somebody out there. So, enjoy the show.
To attempt to flee is a crime punishable by death. One person who escaped remarked, "When I think about it now, I was not a human being. I was more like an animal. Only after leaving did I realize what life was supposed to be."
All right. Thanks for coming back. We've got an amazing show. My guest was raised in a religious cult, suffering years of mental, physical, and sexual abuse. She has since gotten out and is learning to get past all that she has endured. She has never spoken publicly about what she's gone through, and she's here today to share some of that and how she's beaten the odds. Please welcome Sarah Snyder. Sarah, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you so much for coming on. All right. So I guess let's just jump in. What's your earliest memory of growing up in this cult? It was your whole life, correct?
Correct. I was born into it. And so I always like to tell people I can tell my childhood in a way that you would think I had the most perfect, idyllic childhood of anyone you'd ever met. But you know, that's kind of how it looked from the outside, right? But then behind the scenes, things were very different. But I was born into it generationally. So my grandparents were in it, you know, so it's been a thing throughout my family. Yeah.
So the whole family has been in it for how long? Do you know how long they've been in it?
This particular cult was formed in the late 1800s. So I don't actually know kind of how far it goes back, but it goes back a couple generations on one side of the family. On the other side, my other parent was came into it later in life. But my one parent was raised in it, and then her parents were in it. And I think her parents were in it, right? So it's been a while.
Wow. That's a long time. Yeah. So one side has pretty much been there since the beginning?
It's been a couple generations. Let me put it that way. It's been several. Yeah.
This is in the Midwest. I know we're not going to get into what it is and all that. I'm sure people can figure that out for themselves if they wanted to.
Probably.
If
they Google, they could probably figure it out. But I'll say this, most of my family, not my entire family, but the majority of my family is still involved in it. So out of respect, you know, for them, I don't want to specifically name what it is, but yeah.
Yeah, no, that's completely understandable. So I guess kind of take me through, I mean, as much as you can, was there like lessons? Was there like a meeting house that you guys would go to every day?
So there's a couple things. One is some of the things, you know, when you look at them on a surface level, this is the thing. When you look at them on a surface level, you're like, well, that's not that bad, right? So women are subjective to men. In church, you know, the women don't speak, right? The man is the household, the man speaks. Now, how terrible is that? You know, there's a lot of churches probably that would go along with that. Women need to wear head coverings, right? We wear dresses because, you know, you were in church, right? Outside of church, I could kind of wear what I wanted to wear, right?
Is it like your whole face is covered or just like your hair?
No. Like a head covering because your hair is your glory, which is part, you know, I know people can't see me, right? But I have real short hair now, right? So, but growing up, I had really, really, really long hair. And that's because my hair is the glory of a woman, right? So my dad wanted me to have very long hair, so I did. It was very legalistic is what it was. So it was very much follow the rules. And if you follow the rules, God loves you and approves of you. But if you don't follow the rules, you know, we don't approve of you and it's not okay. And so to this day, I struggle with that, with the transactional love, even in my everyday kind of relationships. So one of the things that we did was we did the Bible readings every night, right? So we read out of the Bible every night, which again, is that a terrible thing? Probably not, right? But we had to read from the Bible every night. You go through the Bible, the Old Testament once a year, the New Testament twice a year, right? Based on these things. But there were foundational, quote unquote, brethren. to this particular cult. And so everything in the Bible is discerned through these two particular brethren. And so the people in the cult do not believe that you or I or a Christian has the Holy Spirit, but they believe these two men were, quote unquote, blessed by the Holy Spirit, which is how they're able to discern the Bible in a way that, you know, we can understand. It was a lot of fear-based and a lot of manipulation. So there wasn't a commune, because I do get that question quite a bit from close friends. I said, were you in a commune? I said, no, I went to typical school, right? I interacted with people, which is the part where it's like, oh, it could be idyllic, right? Like my dad coached my softball team. You know, like that's the kind of stuff where people are like, huh? But it's the manipulation kind of behind the scenes and how things were twisted and turned and how I was treated and some of the situations that came up, right, that I was made to handle in ways that now as an adult, I can look back and be like, oh, that was not okay.
Because this is normal to you. Like, that's what I think a lot of people don't understand is, you know, why didn't you just leave? Why didn't you get out? Well, that's normal. You don't know that it's different than everyone else, right?
Not only did I not realize it wasn't different, but you also have to understand if I leave, I lose my whole family, essentially, right? Which is kind of what's happened. To this day, the interactions with my family typically revolve around trying to convert me to come back. So yes, we love you, but we love you because you're a sinner and we want to try and convert you to come back. It's not your typical, I love you because you're you. It's like, I love you because I'm trying to save you kind of behavior. And so when I left I didn't leave till my early 20s, believe it or not. And when I left in my early 20s, I had horrible, horrible nightmares that Christ was going to come back, right? And then that I was going to be judged to be found unfavorable and go to their version of hell. And that, you know, there was going to be like the weeping and gnashing of teeth and just awful nightmares for a long time. But thankfully I have and had a very good friends, right, who are very supportive and loving and kind of helped me through that. But people don't realize not only are you giving up your family, not only are you giving up what you've all you've known your whole life, not only are you giving up your version, the only version of God you've ever known, but you're also giving up your identity too, right? So one of the things people don't realize a lot is I was raised to play the piano. So I learned how to play the piano as a young kid up until I was in high school. I think I quit refusing piano lessons because I was being a stubborn teenager, right?
Right.
But I learned to play the piano because I was being raised to play for church. So I played for church. It's like hymnals. So the whole church was singing as I played the hymnals. When you leave, like you kind of lose some of that identity of like, who am I? Like, why did I learn to play the piano? What was the point of that? And so there's just a huge shift kind of in everything that happens when you leave it, something like that.
I can imagine that would be terrifying. Did you have friends help you get out, or was it something that you just did one day? You just left and didn't turn back?
So I left. I was raised up in the Midwest, and I left when I turned 18. I thought, I surely have to get out of this house I was raised in, right? I have to get out of here. So I actually had started having problems in school with my grades when I was like 15, 16. And I realized I couldn't get a scholarship for college if I didn't get my stuff together and start getting better grades. So I turned myself around, got better grades so I could go to college. So I took off, went to college in Texas. And I, you know, 18, 19, 20, still being involved in that community, but in a community that was close to my college there in the Texas area. And still thinking like, they've got to be right. This has to be right. How could this be wrong? And they say things like, well, we have the truth. Everybody else doesn't have the truth. And you can be in the world, but not be of the world, right? And that sticks in your head where you're like, well, I can be around people, but I'm not actually like them. I'm like the cult, right? That's my home. That's my family. That's who I'm like, right? I'm not like these other people, even though you start to get to know people and you're like, huh, maybe things were a little messed up, right? Yeah. But it doesn't click. And so I was in my early 20s and I started not going as often to the church meetings and the cult meetings, right? The Sunday service, the Wednesday service, Thursday service, I stopped going as much and people started to notice. And so the brethren came to talk to me and said, well, you need to start showing up. You know, you need to be here because basically if Christ returns and you're not fellowshipping, if you're not breaking bread and you're in a world of hurt, you can be judged unfavorably by Christ for that. So you need to be showing up. And I mentioned that to some of my buddies who, you know, were kind of talking to me all along because they're typical not cult people, right? And they're like, Sarah, this is weird. Like, this is way weird, right? Anyway, finally, after some time with them, I actually had to write a letter to say that I was no longer going to be a member of this particular community. So I wrote a letter and sent it in because I couldn't even tell them face to face, like, I'm leaving, I'm not coming back, because it was so emotional for me. So I wrote a letter and they publish or they read the letter, publish it, whatever. And then they officially kick me out. It's to the point where you can't even withdraw yourself from this community. You can say I'm leaving, but they actually have to quote unquote disfellowship you, right? So that I was disfellowshipped after I wrote the letter saying I don't want to be a part anymore. I'm not going to come anymore. But it's things like that, right? That just, it's not like you just quit going to church. Like there's actually like a whole legal law rule systems that they follow.
It almost sounds like when you get fired from a job and you say, no, I quit. You can't. Like they flipping it on you. Like that kind of thing to make themselves feel better.
It was really getting myself to a point where I was hanging out more and more with people who were not in that environment, people who were very loving to me and didn't judge me, but maybe gently question some things I would say. And they would say, why is this so important? Are there other things you can maybe consider? So all of that helped.
So it's kind of in college, you kind of started realizing maybe this isn't completely normal.
Yeah, it opened up my bubble. So as a kid, we traveled a lot, but everything we traveled to were gatherings or like conferences. So yeah, I traveled and people were like, oh, you travel all the time. Well, yeah, I went to other countries and I went to other places, right? But it was always for these religious gatherings. And I had friends in school, typical average American kids, but it wasn't until I was in college when I was more and more removed and I wasn't going to the gatherings as much and I was making more friends kind of on my own without my parents knowing everything I was doing, right? That kind of stuff. When you cut your typical college freedom, you start getting more freedom and you start questioning things a bit more.
So do you think that kind of surprises me that they let you go to regular school and let you go away to college because then they lose their control.
So this is interesting, right? Because it's kind of split within the cult. It's funny because there's some people that are super strict, right? And there's some people that are super relaxed. And it was actually split. And my parents actually got a lot of flack because my dad actually encouraged me to go to college. And he got a lot of flack for that, for encouraging me to go to college because of that fear. And I went to school to be a therapist and I got a ton of flack for that because you're supposed to solve your problems, right, with God and Jesus and the community. And so why would you go to school to become a therapist? Like if you're going to make that risk, why would you make that risk to go be a therapist? That's just even worse, right? So that said, you know, I should probably explain this. So there's a very broad overhead of this particular type of cult. And there's probably about 50,000 maybe give or take across the world of this very broad overhead. But then there are subsects, right? So there's like little niches of this with different names. And so I was raised in one of the stricter of the subsects of this particular cult. And then it just so happens that the majority of my family tends to be a little bit stricter of that. So it's like one upon the other upon the other. So
is there like one main leader for each subset of it, or is there just one main guy?
So this is their fascinating argument as to why they're not a cult, because they don't have someone today who is alive, who is quote unquote the head. What they do is they actually have I'll call it a board to use. You know, typical English, it's like a board of men who governs each particular church. And so this board of men is the governing body. So they say, well, we're not a cult because we don't have one particular cult leader. We have a board of men who governs each particular, they call it church body, right? So they have these different people, but they all base it on the foundational works, the two main brethren, right, from the late 1800s. Yeah, so that's the other thing too. When I was trying to look at getting out, I kept thinking, well, they can't be that bad. It's not like we're drinking Kool-Aid. It's not like I'm answering to one man. And that's what I try and tell people. Cults don't look the way that you always think they look, right? It's not in the news and in the media. It's so hyped up, this like 100% doomsday, one guy leading everything. And I'm like, it's not always like that, guys. Like there's a lot of stuff that happens that they can kind of get away with looking a little normal when it's not, which is also how they recruit people. Because it's not so scary to recruit somebody when you're like, hey, well, yeah, but it's just a body and we don't have one particular leader. But really, you know, it's this board of men, you know, who kind of determines everything for the church.
That's quite the loophole that they have. Right? They thought that right? through, it sounds like, you know?
Right.
Okay. So take me back. I know you suffered quite a bit of abuse growing up from them. With the abuse, do you know that that's different, or do you think that's just what every kid goes through also?
It is not what every child goes through, but it is what a good handful of kids go through, unfortunately. So I was sexually abused from the time, I mean, my earliest memories are honestly of being sexually abused up until I was about 7. And there is a window, 7 or 8 or so, right? There's a window, there's like a gap of time where I was not being sexually abused. And then it started by a different man from when I was like 10 to 12 ish. So most of my childhood, right, was being sexually abused. And they were, you know, members of the church community, one more highly respected than the other, but they are both members of the church community. And so the way that was handled was by the laws and the governings of the church. It's sad, right, to know that that happens and to know that I'm not the only kid that that happens to. That said, it's not like they're promoting it. It's also, but they also don't really do anything about it. It's like, yeah, it happens and okay, it happens.
So it's not a thing that they practice.
It's not a thing that they practice. It's also not a thing that is a big deal. It's not encouraged. It's not practiced. But it's also like, Sarah, what's the problem? Why can't you just get over it and forgive and go on?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, what, Sarah, why are you talking about it publicly? Like, just, it's, you know, it's between you, him, and God. It's deal with it.
Wow, that's pretty shocking. So when you try to tell somebody this is going on, the sexual abuse, they feel like it's your issue, like it's correct, your fault type thing.
So what I'll tell you is when I outcry, so when the abuse ended when I was 7 or 8, I have asked about that, why that particular abuse ended. I was told that it's because I got big enough that he wasn't interested in me anymore. So my understanding is that people were kind of aware that it was happening, but when they saw it happening, they would quote unquote pick me up and take me away from him. So they would do things like that, but they didn't do anything to like stop it. They didn't report it to the police. They didn't tell him to stop. There was none of that. So that was that section. When I was older and I outcried, I was about 12 when I outcried about the second abuse. And I outcried to someone who was an older relative of mine. She took me to another person who is a part of the governing body of one of the churches. And she said, hey, this is going on. What do we do? Sarah's telling me this is going on. What do we do? And he said, you need to follow Matthew 18, which is a verse in the Bible that basically says, if someone is offending you, you go one-on-one to him and you tell him to stop. And then if he doesn't stop, you go bring other people to the problem. And so the response from this guy was, Sarah, you have essentially sinned against the church and you've sinned against this man doing this to you because you have not told him one-on-one that you don't like what he's doing. And I'm 12. Right.
You're right.
So this particular incident happened at one of the conferences. So I'm left like, well, I got to handle this. Right. So I say, okay. So everybody goes home to their different respective countries and states from the conference. And I go home alone with no one in my particular area knowing what happened or what was happening. Right. And I go back home. In fact, I ended up writing him a letter and told him that to stop and that people knew. And thank God, thank the heavens, thank whatever you want to thank that he did stop. And I got real lucky about that because he could have done. I mean, I was 12. He could have done anything. And he was trusted. My parents trusted, like, you know what I mean? He was a trusted member of the community. Anything could happen, but it didn't, thankfully. And he stopped. And I went about a year with no one knowing. So I was still around him all this time. So he was still my Sunday school teacher until I was baptized, because you have to apply to be baptized and be interviewed to be baptized. And that's a whole nother legalistic procedure. So he was still my Sunday school teacher. I was still around him all the time. About a year later, I started acting out. Right. So I start doing things like self-injuring, dressing in super baggy clothes. At this point, right, it's just too much. And so finally, people kind of came to me and said, Sarah, quit behaving the way you're behaving. Why are you acting this way? Are you so angry? What's wrong with you? And so I finally said, after a while, I coughed it up. I said, well, this was going on with X-Men. This is what happened, blah, blah, blah. And the response I got was, okay, but it's over now. What's the problem?
Oh, no.
We're good. So one of the things in this particular community is that there's a lot of things done in the home. So they do have different places they rent to have church, but a lot of things are done in the home. So it then became a thing where that particular man wasn't allowed to come to my house, right? But we still had church together. I still saw him a couple times a week. I was still going to his house for certain things. And people don't understand what, I don't want to curse, but like how that messes with your mind, right? Yeah, yeah. When everybody around you is telling, and I was, you know, now 13, right? And everybody around you is telling you, what's the problem? What's the big deal? He stopped. And so now I'm dealing with two sets of abuse, two abusers I'm still seeing all the time. It was a really challenging period of time in life for me, right? The good thing is I had some people who came. And this is what I try and tell people. People say all the time, well, how do you help a kid like that, right? I actually had some people, like my high school guidance counselor, that woman was amazing with me. So loving, so kind. And I only saw her, you know, at school, but she didn't fully know what was going on, right? But she kind of had a grasp of what was going on. And she would call me in her office and just sit with me a couple minutes, a couple times a week, and just silly things that she would tell me about her day or whatever. And that is honestly what kept me going. I had teachers who could tell that I was gifted and intelligent. And so they would spend extra time with me after class, you know, reading a book with me or telling me about a book I should read. And it was those little things that people don't understand that is what kept me alive, essentially. It is those little minor, I call them minor, little minor interactions with people being like, oh no, these people do care about me. I am seen, right? I am. And that's kind of what allowed me to get through high school.
Looking back on it, do you think that maybe they knew something was going on? And so that's why?
So at one point I did tell some friends of mine in high school, right, that some of this stuff that had happened, they didn't know the full degree, but I kind of told, because it just, you almost can't, no matter how much you're told to keep quiet about it, right? It's just the point where you're like, I can't, because it's so horrifying all the time, because it's your day in, day out life. And so I finally told some high school friends, and they actually ended up somehow, I don't know how the back end happened, a CPS report ended up getting made at some point. But so Child Protective Services, right? So actually Child Protective Services came to me at one point and actually interviewed me and talked to me about it. But I had already been very well coached that if I was asked about certain things, I was to respond in a certain way. So I responded to CPS in very certain specific ways as really? I'm being interviewed, knowing that.
Can I ask real quick, how did they go about coaching you?
It was a sin to talk bad about another brother in the church. So I knew not to disclose his name, right? Because that would be talking bad about him. I knew to be careful about the specifics, right? And how specific I got about what actually happened, because I had been told that was between me and him, right? So I wasn't to talk about the super specifics, right, about what he did. So I have a sibling. I knew that there was a very good chance that my sibling and I could be completely removed from the home altogether if I disclosed too much, right? And so there was some fear around that, right? How are you going to go to church, and how are you going to break bread on Sunday, right, if you're not in the home with us? Right. That type of stuff.
So it was mostly fear-based.
Yep. There was a lot of fear.
Okay. I think you were talking about telling your friends before I.
Yeah. So So I had told my friends, right? So at some point, like a CPS report got filed. So I think then it started to become more and more within, like, you know, my guidance counselor, right? She knew more. I think my teachers knew a bit more right after some of that happened. But still, what do? You've got a kid who's kind of telling part of the story, but not the full story, right? And who is depressed. But then on the other hand, like, what do you, you know what I mean? The CPS isn't removing her from the home. So it's like this balancing act, right? Of like, what do?
Yeah, that would be tough. Did you ever tell the counselor anything or no?
I ended up telling her bits and pieces. So at one point I figured out, that the way I could get a break from having to be around these men was to say that I was super depressed and go to a psych hospital. So at one point, really? I said, I know, right? So at one point I said, I'm going to kill myself. And I was real adamant about it. And so finally the guidance counselor, and then eventually the guidance counselor said, she's got to go to therapy. You've got to get her to therapy, right? And my parents fought that real hard. But eventually CPS kind of did say, we'll remove her if you don't send her to therapy. So my parents begrudgingly sent me to therapy, and I told my therapist, like, I'm gonna kill myself. so I shouldn't laugh about it, right? But I got, so they sent me to a psych hospital as a teenager, and it gave me a break. It was like the best week of my high school life, which is nuts because you're in a psychiatric hospital where you're locked down, you don't have freedom, but you can't get out, right? And I'm like, dude, I'm safe, we're good. Like, I don't have to see anybody or talk to anybody I don't want to talk to. Like, this is amazing.
Is that when you reflect more in that week and realize, okay, maybe all this is not right, this is not normal?
You know, there was a tech at the hospital, and the tech came up to me one day. I don't know the guy, just his dad, I don't know who he is. He was just work direct care staff, right? He's just working his shift. And he came up to me, and I was sitting on the couch, and he said, why are you here, you know? And I said, I want to kill myself. And he said, well, why do you want to kill yourself? And I said, I was abused and I can't get over it and I want to kill myself. And that man looked me straight up in the face and said, what happened to you was not your fault. And then he got up and went on his way doing his thing. That is the first person I think I ever believed that there was a potential that abuse was not my fault, because I couldn't figure out why he said it to me. Why would a stranger who I don't know come up to me and tell me that when everybody else? And so my therapist was sometimes saying to me, Sarah, what happened wasn't your fault. But I was like, well, you got to see that. You're my therapist. But this guy, out of the blue, like, what? Anyway, that goes back to those little micro interactions, right? I still remember that guy. I still remember him sitting next to me and telling me that the abuse wasn't my fault. And that just rocked my world.
Isn't that bonkers? That it's that little thing that, like, completely changed your world. And it was, you know, it probably was nothing. Almost nothing to him.
He probably didn't remember me or it.
Right. That's pretty cool that, like, changed your whole world. Okay, so before this, does the abuse go on every day?
No, it was not every day. So it was a couple times a week when I was around these particular men. From when I was younger, it was much more frequent. When I was older, it was not as frequent. It was much harder for him to get this extra time alone with me, right? So, you know what I mean? When I was younger, it was a little different. But yeah, we didn't live all in the same spot, so they didn't have as much access to me.
Well, that's good. When do you start telling people, and who do you tell? Are you telling your parents? Do you tell the church leaders?
About which one?
I guess let's start with the first one.
So that's the one that I never said anything about, right? And that's the one where later on, why I said, you know, why did it end? And that's when I was told, you know, you were just too big and he wasn't interested in you anymore. And we did what we could. We took you away from when we noticed stuff. And you know, so that was from when I was that little. When I was older, family member of mine who was a woman, and then she took me to one of the church leaders of the particular board of his church. And so then he's the one that sent me back home. So then I guess it was a year later when I kind of came back and people started saying, what is wrong with you? I finally told somebody. And that particular person is the one who told my parents. But then my parents, right, who were wonderful parents in some respects and very terrible parents in other respects, you know, were kind of the ones that was like, you know, along with the church, right? They went to the church for consult. They consulted with the church, and the church was kind of like, you got to deal with it. So my parents were like, you got to deal with it, right? It happened.
So, and then everybody kind of just blamed you for it.
One of the things that happened later when the church where I was living in found out more, a little bit more about it, they did it eventually kind of tell this guy, like one of the men, they said, you know, you need to probably take a time out for this. And so he recused himself from fellowship for a little bit. He took a little bit of a time out. And so what the church did then is they came to me and they said, we want you to know that his salvation is on you now, because he is supposed to be a member of this body and he's supposed to be here. And he left because you're upset with him. So if Christ returns and he is not in fellowship with us, his salvation is in jeopardy, but so is your religious salvation, because he's left because you are upset about what happened. And I'm like, you know, maybe 13th, like I said, 13th, 14th this time. So that is why today, right, when I try and I think about God, or I sit down, because I consider myself a Christian today, right? So I try and sit and think about God. So much of it has been relearning things, right? And relearning that is not what that Matthew 18 means, right? It doesn't mean that for a kid at all, right? It means that for Christians who are in fellowship with each other, who are adults, right? Who have minor conflicts to go talk to each other. And it's the same thing too with situations like that. Like my salvation isn't based on someone else's actions, right? This is not. But as a kid, like hearing that, like, again, fear-based, right? There's a lot of fear in that. I'm like, oh, they don't believe in heaven and hell like a typical Christian believes in heaven and hell. But anyway, but I'm going to go to hell, right? Because I'm upset with him for molesting me. So that's when I say, you know, is it encouraged? Like, no, it's not encouraged. But also, is it discouraged? It's like, well, no, it's the victim's fault and you just need to deal with it.
And at that age, you're so, like, I'm trying to think back to that age in mine, and this is probably in yours. I mean, I wasn't in a cult, but you're taught to respect your elders and you kind of hang on everything that your parents say to you. And so I'm trying to put myself in your shoes of going to the people I respect and the people I love and telling them that this abuse is going on and then getting blamed for it. Like, that's got to be just excruciating.
You know,
or do you not know? I mean, do you just think it's normal? You think it is your
thing, right? You just think it is normal. Yeah, that's the thing. You know, I tell people now, I get angry sometimes now, like really, really mad about it, right? Like rageful angry. Like, I went out about a year ago, I put some old electronics out in my backyard, and I took a sledgehammer, right? And I beat the old electronics in the backyard with a sledgehammer as hard as for as long as I could until I just could not physically move my body anymore. That's where it's like, it's the healing piece now, right? And that's where the rage, you now it's like I get to feel that rage that really I could have, should have been able to feel as a child. But at the time, you're so, people are saying you're so in it, right? You're so in, like, this is the norm. Like, these are the people I'm supposed to respect. They know the Bible better than me. They know what I'm supposed to be doing, right? I trust them. Trust for me now is a huge factor. Can I trust you? I don't know if I can trust you, right? Like, what are your intentions here? And so that has been a big piece of healing, right? And getting to the point I am now is figuring out some of those things and then letting myself have some of those feelings that really I should have, could have had as a kid that I wasn't able to have, and having them today and figuring out how to cope and how to deal with some of those feelings.
I bet that felt good though. Destroying all
Oh yeah. Beat the sledgehammer. That's great. Yeah.
That's awesome. Do you think
it's like my little rage room in the backyard?
Right. Yes. Exactly. That's so cool. I was picturing, as you're saying it, I'm picturing your neighbors watching you going, "What in the hell is Sarah doing today?"
I have no doubt they wondered, but nobody said anything, thankfully, so we're okay.
Well, I wouldn't have gone near you with a sledgehammer after you destroyed everything. Do you think, so you're talking about coping and stuff. Do you think because your hair was sacred and you have short hair now, do you think that's part of the rebellious part of it, going against it and saying, well, this was so sacred, I'm going to chop it off?
So yeah, yes and no. So for people that can't see, I have like a faux hawk, kind of mohawk thing going on. So yes and no. When I got into college, I cut it shorter and shorter and shorter, kind of in high school, and then into college, I kept cutting it like shoulder length, kind of shorter. That to me was rebellion. The haircut I have today, honestly, is because I tend to be a fairly creative person, especially at work. Like, creativity is really important to me. So we haven't talked about quite about this piece yet, but in October of last year, I picked up and I left Texas and I became quote unquote a digital nomad, right? Aruba for a few months, and I swam with turtles there, and I lived in Costa Rica for a couple months, and I went up a volcano and swam in the oceans there. I did all that fun stuff. And so when I was in Costa Rica, I had about shoulder length hair, and I thought, it's got to go. This isn't me. So I cut a bunch of it off. It's not a rebellion. It's more of a reflection of my journey and who I am today, and more the confidence and the fun and the creativity I get to have in my life today.
I can respect that. I like that. So before, you were telling me about, and you've just kind of discovered this, is dissociative disorder. Is that what it's called?
It's called dissociative identity disorder, DID. Yeah. It used to be called multiple personality disorder, or MPD. One of the coping skills that I developed, and I didn't realize that it was not something that everybody experienced for a long time.
Yeah.
I was about 5 or 6 when I realized. I asked someone who was about my age as a kid, I said, "What are the voices in your head like?" And this particular kid looked at me and said, What voices were you talking about? And I was like, oh, I'm different, but I don't know why I'm different, and I don't know how I'm different.
Right? Just kidding.
So, right. That's what I said. I was like, just kidding. Right. What I'm playing. Right. But dissociative identity disorder, basically you have more than one personality. So what happens is you develop these distinct personalities that take over during times of high stress or during times of trauma. And so they come out, and it's a protective mechanism, right? Because then you don't have to go through what you're going through. Unfortunately, they've made horror movies about it, like Split, right? Is a horror movie that they've made about DID, but it's actually a beautiful coping skill. It is just no longer effective to live life with once you're out of the traumatic environment.
Is it, real quick, is it a genetic thing, or is it the coping thing? It comes on because of the trauma.
It comes on because of trauma. So it is typically developed in intense childhood traumatic situations, which are ongoing and difficult to escape or unable to be escaped, because you have to go somewhere in your mind when that stuff's happening. And so it is much easier to develop another personality to take over and deal with whatever's happening than it is for you to sit there and experience that. I would be probably 100% all the time in an insane asylum if I hadn't developed DID.
Oh, wow. So that's how your brain copes with
what was happening.
Oh, wow.
So what happened was I, as an adult, so later in life, right, as an adult, I was hospitalized a couple of times due to severe depression, because I was actively suicidal. And so I was hospitalized a couple of times. And as I was in the hospital, the doctor said to me, "We think you have dissociative identity disorder." But I knew that was a fairly serious diagnosis. And I said, "No, I don't. Thank you so much. Have a good day." "No, I don't." And then in one of the hospitalizations, they came to me and they said, "Sarah," they said, you've been through some stuff, right?" They said, "But we don't know really how to help you unless you're willing to commit to a minimum of 3 months in a psychiatric hospital, like lockdown all the time with us, so that you can talk about what you've been through and get through all of it. And we can basically like kind of then patch you up and put you back together." And I said, "I don't have 3 months. Are you kidding me? Like I have been very successful career wise, right?" I said, "I don't have 3 months." Thank you so much. Have a good day. Right. They said, "Well, all we can do for you is put a patch on you then and go about your way." And I had convinced myself that I had early onset Alzheimer's, because one of the things with DID is when the personalities take over is you lose chunks of time. So I would go to the grocery store and come out, and I had had no idea what I bought. It's kind of like when you're driving, right? You're driving, you're like, how did I get here? Right? You kind of drive from point A to point B, and you're like, oh, I do this right all the time, and you just kind of what? But it's for much more significant periods of time, and it's where I'll meet people sometimes, Mike, especially when I was in Texas still. I would meet people, and I'm so sorry, I had no idea who they are, where they came from, and apparently we have had a couple interactions, right? But I don't know who they are. So, you know, you learn to just smile and nod and say, uh-huh, say, oh, yeah, that was a great party, whatever, right?
Right.
And just talk through it. I call it like waking up. So I would kind of come to or wake up sometimes, and I would be in the middle, like especially at college when it was high stress, like I had to give a presentation. I would like wake up and be in the middle of talking. I had no idea what I was talking about, no idea where I was, no idea who I was talking to, right? And you learn real quick to like focus and be like, and finish whatever you're talking about.
Really?
It's because another personality was out doing whatever it needed to do, right? And then all of a sudden, they call it the main or the host personality, right? Which is me, the person you're talking to today, right? Comes out and it's like, uh-oh, like what is going on here? What are we doing, right?
Right.
But I thought I had early onset Alzheimer's. That was the only thing because I refused to accept the DID diagnosis. And so I was like, well, that's got to be what it is. But what else could it be? And then it was about maybe 6 or 7 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, I met a really wonderful therapist. She's a lovely woman there in Texas. And she was like, Sarah, like you've been hospitalized a couple times. They've talked to you about this. I really think this is something that you should consider exploring as a possibility, right? The CID. And so finally in working with her, I was able to accept that was an actual diagnosis, but I had full transparency plan on living the rest of my life with DID. Right? I was like, this is how the rest of my life's going to be. And then about a year and a half ago, I met a wonderful woman who is an international trauma specialist. And she worked with me and still does work with me. And she is wonderful, right? And she worked with me and got me to a point where it was never the intent of us working together, but I'm to the point now where I consider myself cured. I don't consider myself to have DID anymore. They would call me a singular, right? Not plural anymore. There's only one.
Right.
And I tell people, I want to be respectful, right? Because there's a lot more people in the world that have DID than what people realize. There's successful doctors, therapists, lawyers, the whole gamut, right? That have DID. And a lot of people don't want their personalities to go away because it is a very scary thing to live life differently without them. And I'll give you a prime example. When I was in Aruba this last year, I was out swimming in the ocean and seeing the turtles in the ocean, right? Having a wonderful day with my local friends there. And I got stung by a jellyfish. And if I still had DID, I would have been hurting for about 30 seconds. Another personality would have taken over and I would have lost the rest of the day. Wouldn't have remembered it. I also would not have been in pain, right? as a quote unquote singular person, right? I got stung by the jellyfish and I was like, oh, this hurts, right? And I remember telling my local buddy there, I'm like, this hurts. And he's like, dude, you got stung by a jellyfish. Of course it hurts. I'm like, no, but it still hurts, right? It still hurts. And he's like, of course it still hurts. I'm like, yeah, but it still hurts. And so I'm sure you was probably like, what is wrong with this woman?
Right.
but the positive of that, right, is I remember the rest of the day. I remember, you know, having the rest of the day, having lunch with him, right? I remember hanging out with my other friends in the evening. I remember joking about the jellyfish stuff. Like, I remember all of that. So it's like, you know, pros and cons. And I tell people today, sometimes I get lonely and people are like, oh yeah, okay, you're lonely. And I'm like, no, I don't have people in my head talking to me anymore. I mean, like my head is quiet. Like I am lonely. Like, I don't know how you people deal with not having friends in your head to talk to all the time. Like, I am lonely. And so there's pros and cons to having it cured, right? Like, I would much rather have it cured and live the life I have today. But there's some difficult things I've had to give up and change about my life.
Okay, so the disorder. So you have the voices in your head. Is it kind of a thing where when it's just you, when it's just Sarah,
mm-hmm.
they're all there and you can talk to them and have a conversation with them type thing, and you can remember that. But if one of them takes over, then you can't remember that.
Correct. So yes and no, says my answer to that. They were not all present all the time in my head, right? So they were not, it's not like all of them were all in my head and I talked to them all the time. Sometimes they would kind of come and go into the background, right? As far as who I could talk to and who I could talk to. One, because it probably sounds silly, but they would get mad at me sometimes, right? Because they wouldn't agree with decisions I made and they would get mad and like disappear, right? And I wouldn't be able to talk to them anymore. Or one would want my attention more than the other. It was literally like running a household in your head, right?
No kidding.
So there's that. But I could generally remember conversations with them, right? Or different pieces with them. But then when they call it fronting. So when one would front, that's when I would lose track of time or not know what my quote unquote physical body had done. And I got to a point in therapy where I would sometimes ask them, like, hey guys, I'm missing this chunk of time. Can someone please tell me what happened? What did we do? And so that is a gamble, as if they're actually going to give you the information on what you did with that particular period of time or not, right? But it's weird to explain to people, right? But it saved my life. So as much, sometimes I feel I would call inappropriate shame about it, but I'm also so grateful that I had it to get through what I got through.
That's interesting. So when you call upon one of the other ones, it's a gamble. You don't know if they're going to come out or if they're going to tell you the truth of what happened.
Right.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. Wow. So that's kind of true. Like, I mean, that's pretty much what I know about it is from Split, the movie that you just spoke about. But it's kind of like, it's almost, I mean, not to that extreme, obviously, you're not out killing people, but it's kind of the same concept where he doesn't know what the other ones are doing.
Yep. So the big piece of it and what really helped me heal was, like I said, I started working with this woman, Dawn, and she took the time to get to know each one of my personalities. And I hadn't really done that with anyone. So I hadn't trusted anyone or felt safe enough with anyone for them to actually get to know each personality. And she got to know each personality and would like communicate with them individually, like talk to them, spend time with them. And all of a sudden, like I started to feel like safer and they started to feel safer almost with each other. And then as time progressed in my coaching and trauma work that we did, she was just so patient and so kind and so calm with each one of them. And some of the personalities preferred to write, some preferred to talk, some preferred to yell, right? It just, you know, like one of my personalities was a kid, right? And so there was a lot of like childlike kind of interactions. And so in her kind of helping work through that, and then it helped me kind of heal that. And then there was a point in time where, you know, kind of like I mentioned before, right? When I was in the psych hospital and they had told me, well, in order for you to get through this, you've got to spend at least three months with us to break you down, right? And a piece of that was I had never told anybody the severity of what I had gone through as a young child. So no one knew how bad that had been. And Dawn came into my life and she said, Sarah, she said, the issue isn't with you. Because I thought I was weak. I thought, well, I can't tell anybody this because I'm weak, right? It's my fault. I lived through it, but I'm too weak to tell people about it. And Dawn said, that's ridiculous, Sarah. She said, it's not you. It's not that you're weak. You lived it. You survived it. You can talk about it. She said, the issue is the onus is on me for you to be able to trust me to walk you through the emotions that you're going to experience as you're telling me what happened to you. And so after we had started work, she and I started working together for a couple months, it finally got to that point where I felt safe enough. And she sat, she's actually in another country. So she sat over Zoom with me for about 3.5 hours. And I told her everything that I could remember that happened to me from with the personalities, everything that had happened to me from the time when I was little up until I was about 7 or so. And that was the most healing experience I think I've ever had. I woke up the next day and I was like, oh my goodness, I felt so free. Like just that it was out. I tell people, you have to be careful. You can't just like go tell anybody, right? It's really got to be someone who can sit and walk you through the emotions and walk you through the experience and walk you through the feelings that you have and walk you through the memories and make sure you don't get stuck in a memory, right? That you can actually walk through it and talk through it. And that has completely changed my life. And it was not but long after that, that the personalities all kind of disappeared. Again, this probably sounds strange, right? But we sat down and I talked to them. They agreed that I was kind of safe enough to take care of myself. And I agreed I was safe enough to not need them. And then it wasn't, but a little bit longer, I woke up one morning and they were gone. And I remember being like, what is this? My head is so quiet, right? And then it clicked. I said, oh, they're gone. They're gone. I say I've traveled since then, right? And I've been in times of really high stress. And I've actually, at one point, I broke down crying. I said, guys, please come back. I miss you. Please come back. And they didn't. And so it's weird, right? They're gone. But I say they're gone, but they're also, it is who I am today, right? It is me, because they were all essentially pieces of me. It's just all in one now, right? Rather than a fragmented puzzle.
So they're still there. You perceive them as gone because you're not you can't speak to them? Are you speaking out loud or is it in your, you're just talking like in your thoughts?
So it was in my thoughts, but there were times when it would get so chaotic and so loud that I would kind of yell at them out loud. But typically the conversations, right, were all in my head. So you wouldn't know, like I said, I've been extremely successful in my life. Like you would have no idea to meet me on the street. You know, you might think it's weird that we do something together and I don't remember the details, right? Right. So people would tell me, they'd be like, so we knew you're a little weird. Like we knew some a little off, but you know, I had great friendships. I had romantic relationships. I traveled, you know, I did all these things. And so people, that was the other challenging thing, right? Was trying to explain to people, yeah, I have DID, right? And now I have to explain to people, yeah, I'm cured of DID, right? So, you know, people don't typically know or notice. It's not as dramatic as what they make it out to be a lot of times in the movies or on TV.
Can most people be cured of this or is this a pretty unique case?
I don't really know of anyone other than one other woman who is out saying that she's cured. There are people who will say they have quote unquote integrated. So that is when all the personalities come together. So there are people in the world who say I'm integrated. But most people who I know of in the studies I've read will say that even if you're integrated, you can still in times of high stress call out the personalities. So day to day you're integrated, day to day you're singular, but high stress or high whatever environments will bring them back out, right? And then you put them back in. I have been in extremely stressful, high stress situations this last year and a half. They're gone. And so that's how I'm able to confidently say I'm cured, right? Which is rare. It's not considered a curable diagnosis.
What's the usual treatment for it? Is it medication?
So you cannot treat DID with medication. Most people will say that you learn to live with it. So you learn to communicate with the personalities effectively enough that they stop taking over all the time. And so they kind of live in the background. Or you do the integration route, which a lot of people with DID don't want to do for good reason. It's scary, right? And so then there's the potential for integration. But a lot of people just learn to manage the community in their head in a way that is effective where they can live life and go on. I will say, though, I was at one point in my life, even though meds don't treat DID, I was on at one point 15 different psychiatric meds at a time. And when I met Dawn this last year and a half ago, when I met her, I was on 12 at a time. So I was on like a mood stabilizer, I was on an upper, I was on a downer, I was on one for my attention span, I was on one to help me sleep, I was one to help me in nightmares. I could go on and on, right? So I'm on these 12 different medications. And I was having suicidal thoughts every day. A lot of the intent was gone, but I still was just miserable. I was so sad, like so depressed and so sad. So for me to be able to look you in the eye today and say, like, I'm not on any psychiatric meds. I haven't been on any psychiatric meds in like at least 7 months. I haven't taken any.
Wow.
I consider myself cured. I'm happy. I love my life. I love my business. I love my friends. You know, I'm learning about God. And that too, right, is huge to be able to sit and learn about God and stay present and not think about all the trauma and not think about all the manipulation and not think about the things that were done to me as I was learning about God as a kid, right? And to stay focused. It's a night and day different life today.
It really is incredible. And everything you've gone through. And this is just recent. You said 7 months. So during the pandemic, when you're cooped up, do you think that helped in the healing process?
So there's a couple things. The pandemic helped in some ways in that it almost gave me more time to focus on myself and my personal healing and my personal growth because you're stuck, right? So what are you gonna focus on but working yourself?
Yeah.
But it also got me to a point, the pandemic did, where I decided I wasn't gonna live in fear anymore. And I decided I would be smart about my life and I'd be smart about the decisions I made. But when October hit, I said, I'm not living in fear anymore. I'm not doing this anymore. Which is when I took off for Aruba, right? And so I went to live in Aruba because I said, I deserve to have a life of joy. And so, yeah.
And so you've gone off and you're living your life. You're not stuck in that kind of rut, I guess. Is that kind of what?
Yeah. Before, like I said, I had thoughts almost every day of wanting to kill myself. I did them every day. And I don't remember the last time I thought about killing myself. And in fact, I write a lot on Facebook just to give people an idea. And I wrote on Facebook the other day and said, I sat on the couch and cried and I beat myself up for it, right? I felt bad about it because I spent a day on the couch crying. And it was funny because Dawn reminded me, she said, Sarah, when we first started working together, you couldn't cry physical tears. And one of your goals was to be able to cry. So she said, this is great. What are you talking about? Like, why are you upset about this? This is wonderful. Like you sat and were sad and cried for a day. So it's things like that that people don't realize that that's huge progress. And so the life I have today is really a blessing with the sadness, with the ups, with the downs, with all that. It's really a gift and I'm thankful for it.
So you're just basically relearning everything.
I'm relearning what healthy love looks like. I'm relearning what God looks like. I'm relearning, that it's okay to cry. I'm learning that it's okay to have joy. I'm learning that it's okay to kind of live the life I want to have without being in fear all the time. I'm learning how to ask what I want. I'm learning how to ask for what I need, right? Because so many of my needs weren't met or weren't shut down or weren't safe to ask for, right? And so I even texted a friend here the other day and I said something about coming over for a hug. And it was so nice. To be able to say like, hey, I'm kind of having a bad day. Can you come give me a hug? Right.
Yeah.
That's something I wouldn't have really done before. And somehow it's funny. Some of my friends who've been my friends for, 15 or so years, they actually say, Sarah, we don't always know how to show up for you today. They said, we love you and we care about you, but you're not in the bed crying and depressed and needing us to come drag you out of bed and make sure you're functioning,
Yeah.
They said, we how do you want us to show up for you? Like, we don't know what you need in our friendship. As sad as that is, it's also beautiful, right? To be like, dude, I need you to come visit me. I need you to come travel. I need you to come, tell me a joke, right? Tell me about your kids. Tell me about what you're doing with your life. I want to hear about your stuff. It's really amazing.
Oh, I can imagine. It sounds like it's completely night and day. You spoke about Dawn a little bit. I think we were going to bring her in. Should we try to get her on here and talk to her for a second?
Yeah.
She can kind of help us go through what her process was, I guess, in helping you.
Yeah. There's lots of people, right, who have experienced sexual abuse. There's lots of people in the world who have DID. There's lots of people in the world who are digital nomads, right? There's lots of people who have been depressed. I'm just lucky enough to be in the point where I've made it to where I made it. And, there's lots of people who have survived cults or there's some people who are in cults. But what I want people to know really at the end of the day is that it is possible to heal and that it is possible to get to a point where you can enjoy your life. And so I want to encourage people to not stop fighting for themselves. In other words, like always keep fighting for yourself. I've had people tell me along the way, we don't know what to do. Professionals say to me, Sarah, we don't know what to do for you anymore. Like you're so basically like, we have tried to help you and we've tried to help you and we don't know what to do for you anymore. And so what I try and tell people today is don't stop fighting. Even if you hear that, go find someone who does know what to do for you. Right.
Find
someone who can help you right with what you're going through.
Right. I imagine, did you go through just a ton of different therapists and doctors? And
so I did. Yeah. I've seen a couple more than a couple, quite a few doctors. I've seen quite a few therapists. I've seen quite a few treatment professionals and some are better than others. And I'm grateful for everyone that tried to meet me where I was at. Grateful for people doing what they could to help.
How do you get the strength, I guess, to keep going after them not knowing and them telling you how they can't help you, basically? How do you keep going because you're already in, you're not in a very good state, right?
It was the micro interactions. I focused on the fact I have a niece and a nephew who I love to pieces. And some days that almost wasn't enough, right? But I focused on how much I love and care about those two kids. I focused on my friend's kids who I love to pieces. I focused on, someone would send me a text sometime and just be like, hey, I'm thinking out of the blue. Hey, I'm thinking about you. Hey, I love you. People don't understand this. Sometimes those littlest things in the world and you don't expect that but it's like, I can do this today. Sometimes there's just a random phone call or a random like, hey, like I'm bringing your favorite dinner tonight. I'm like, well, why? I don't know. I just thought you might need it. Sometimes it was a boss giving me a compliment, telling me how good I was at my job. And I tried so hard to hang on to those little things.
Yeah. It's just incredible what you've overcome. And to come out on the other side, like just so much stronger and with a completely different perspective on everything.
And that's the thing. I don't ever want anyone to go through what I went through. I don't ever want anyone to have the experiences I've had in life. I think they're awful. Even the people who did this to me, I don't want them to ever go through what I went through. I mean that. But that said, I have learned that I have to find the good and what I can. So one of the things I often say is the DID even cured is a big piece of my creativity, or it's a big piece of how I think differently. So that's a big thing for me. People tell me sometimes, especially newer friends, they say, Sarah, you're so thankful. You're always so grateful and so thankful. It makes me laugh. I say, I try real hard to be, because I didn't get to have the same gratitude that I have today for the things, because I don't know. People say you appreciate things more. And I'm like, well, yeah, because I didn't have them before. So now they mean a lot to me, even though it might be something that you grew up with and you're used to, right? And you had every day. It absolutely means the world to me today. I don't know if you heard the door knocking a second ago, but one of my friends knew I was doing this podcast. And so she actually sent her kids over to check, right? So they thought I'd be done by now, right? Oh. So they're knocking on the door. I saw them through the window walking up. and they were knocking on the door and be like, you know, hey, are you ready to come see me? That to me means the world to me. Like, are you kidding me? Like, you took time out of your day because you knew I was a little bit anxious and stressed about this podcast to come check on me out of the blue, right? Oh, and how am I not going to be thankful for that, right?
Right, yeah.
And so, but you know.
Yeah, no, I completely get what you're saying. That's awesome to appreciate all the little things. Do you still have any contact with any of your family that's still there?
So I do, because remember, they want to reconvert me. So it's very much a healthy boundaries thing for me. And that's something I've been working on, is what do healthy boundaries look like? What does love look like?
Oh, I think she's here.
She says she's in the waiting room. Yeah.
Oh, there she is. And Dawn?
Hello.
Oh, there we go.
Howdy.
Hey.
How are you today?
I'm doing really good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So we've just
you're talking to Sarah.
Yeah, we've been. She just went through some of the stuff. It's just incredible.
Yeah, it is.
She credits you, you know, to helping her. So okay, so kind of give me your background. How did you get into all this stuff?
Absolutely. So I also had a really, really crazy childhood, with everything from sexual abuse to eating disorders, suicide attempts, had a brain aneurysm at 17, infertility, drug addiction. Like, if it could happen to a person, it's happened to me. And through all of it, I kept seeing therapist after psychologist and psychiatrists, and trying all the meds and doing all the things, and nothing was really working for me. And I hit a point where I was done with life. And I told my husband, I said, I'm going to cash in all of our retirement, all of our savings, sell belongings, do whatever I have to do. Man, that boy deserves a hero cookie. And I'm going to spend a year doing anything and everything in my power to heal my own brain. And one of the things I needed was like strategy. So like, how do you actually heal a brain? How do you neurologically rewire a brain? And sometimes you feel so far gone that you need someone to actually be like, okay, here's our action plan. Here's the steps. This is what we're going to do. This is what I want you to do. And I started figuring that out for myself and started healing all of my trauma from my childhood. And people started asking advice on how I was so happy and doing so well when I had dealt with what I had dealt with. And so I started laying out plans for people as well. And that's where it started. And someone offered me money one day.
Even better.
I had all these trainings and all these certifications from learning how to do it with my own health and just a deep love of people, and realizing that if I was feeling that broken and I was feeling that lost and I was feeling like the system was not working for my brain and where I was at, there had to be other people out there feeling the same.
So you pretty much experienced a lot of the stuff that Sarah dealt with, you know, the abuse.
Yeah.
I mean, were you blamed for it like she was?
I was blamed in a different way. So I'm one of the rare people that actually told my parents immediately after it happened. So it was my uncle. He'd abused me over 2 days and about 14 times. And right after the last one happened, I heard my dad go into the bathroom across the hall from where my bedroom was at my aunt and uncle's house. And I raced in there and told him everything that had happened.
Good for you.
And instead of going and beating him up or calling the cops or anything like that, he walked me back to the bedroom, stayed there while I got dressed. And then I had to sit beside the guy at the breakfast table while he felt me up under the table. We had to pose for family photos on the front steps. They acted like nothing had happened. And it was ridiculous. And I remember just thinking, am I like, what is even happening right now? Like, I just told you this, you should be more angry.
Yeah.
And we got in the car to drive away. And my dad told my mom what had happened. And I'll never forget it. She turned around and looked at me and went, wow, the things you'll do for attention. No, I'm not buying you anything when we go shopping today. And we ended up spending all day in town shopping with cousins and aunts and uncles and grandparents. And the whole time I was just in a state of shock. And so, yeah, my
like
whole
I'm
life.
In now.
Yeah, they never believed me. I don't know if my parents believed me to this day.
Really? How old were you?
I was 14.
Oh my gosh. And so they thought this was just, you were trying to get attention.
Yeah. And they even, his wife wrote a letter admitting his guilt, and they still never were like, hey, we believe you.
So his wife knew.
Like, it was, oh yeah, his wife knew. He abused other people in the family. People talked about it. Just nobody did anything about it. Abuse is very interesting in how it's dealt with within family units.
I think we're learning that and like how prevalent it actually is now, because I think people are getting the strength to speak about
Huge.
It finally.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
But see, this is kind of the interesting piece. I know, Mike, you had kind of asked about my healing journey, right? And yep. This is the interesting piece. Being able to have kind of real, authentic discussions with Dawn about this kind of stuff made a difference for me in healing, and knowing that she actually got where I had you know, her story is different than mine, but she understood where I had been. And that made her safer, right? To be able to talk to about a lot of the stuff I went through. Cause I'm like, oh no, you actually get me. And I can see right where you're at a progress point in your healing. And so you've got some knowledge right that I don't have. And her ability to walk me through my emotions, right? As I'm talking about these different things, I credit a lot to her having these experiences. And so it almost goes back to the thing I told you too, where I'm not grateful for what happened to me. I don't wish it on anybody, but if it's able to help someone at some point, then I hope it does, to know that they can also get through whatever they've been through.
I think it will, that you've two have overcome so much. Dawn, did you have a multiple personality thing also, or what was your brain's coping mechanism, I guess, for it?
Oh gosh, not multiple personalities in like a diagnosed way or anything like that. But I actually did something really different where I learned how to shut off my physical pain and my emotional pain to a disconnected point where my body would have infections and I would have no symptoms of it because I had disconnected it to such a strong level. So because my trauma started at such a young age and I felt this bonding issue due to issues with like my mom in utero and trying to miscarry me and all kinds of different things that had happened, I learned, and I remember vividly the first time I did it, where I felt super strong emotional pain and I pushed it. Like I watched myself push it down into my finger and I pictured it in the end of my finger. And then I pinched the end of my finger as hard as I could. I just sat there and watched it. I remember where I was sitting in my parents' backyard and I sat and watched it until the pain actually disappeared and it just went numb. And I was like, there, my emotional pain's gone. And I walked away from it. And I used that tactic without realizing I was doing it for years. And my husband used to laugh at me because I would do things like we'd go on a really long road trip and I would be like, you're just not going to pee. And I'd look down at my body and be like, you're just not going to go to the bathroom for the next like 14 hours, figure it out. And I wouldn't, or I'd have to go. And I would do this like shoulder roll thing where I would just like shut it off, where I could actually physically shut off my feels. So after the brain aneurysm, I had debilitating blackout migraines every single day for almost 20 years. And I would jump out of bed in the morning and determine like based on how hard I threw up would determine how my day was going to go.
I
would deal with every day, blacking out, falling downstairs. Like it was nuts. But I learned how to like hold my eyes different. I learned how to hold my body different. And my husband's like, yeah, you do that shoulder thing where you just kind of like go and done. Now you're good and you don't feel any physical pain. So I did something very different, but similar, where I shut off physical pain because so much of my trauma was based on that, like a broken back and a brain aneurysm and all these things where there was so much actual physical pain. I just learned to shut it off where people would look at me and go, you're not in pain, are you? And I'd be like, oh yeah, like dying right now. And nobody knew.
Wow.
And then I would just transfer my emotional pain into the physical pain and then shut off the physical pain. So that's how I disconnected.
Is all the physical pain, do you think that's caused from the abuse?
You know what? Not only the abuse, but epigenetics. Like there's so much science right now on things like epigenetics and the fact that we hold our ancestors' trauma in our DNA for up to 3 generations, but also that we hold our own emotional trauma in our body. Like we hold emotions in our body. So yeah, that causes pain. So there was a lot of that sort of stuff that I had to work through and I had to deal with, that as I shifted, my body was so sensitive that it develops full allergies based on trauma that I'm dealing with. To this day, if I have like a conversation with someone about like my childhood sexual abuse or my mom's death or different things, my body will have complete like visceral like reactions to what is going on now that it's reconnected and that I've reconnected that. So I actually feel physical pain now, which is really irritating, by the way. It's healthy, but it's really irritating.
That Sarah said the same thing, actually. That's interesting. Okay, so you cashed out the savings and you go to heal yourself. Can you talk about how you did that?
I read every book. I went to conferences. I went to all kinds of things. I went to like Hoffman Process, where I learned about like family patterns and all those things. And you do almost like rage work or like cathartic work of releasing like emotion from your body. And so I'd be like, oh, I wonder if I could take that and use that in this area of my life and then this area and then this area. And I mean, this is before you could actually just sit and Google things, right? So I was doing a lot of like sitting in libraries and reading textbooks on and books on like, how do you neurologically rewire a brain? How do you process this sexual abuse? How does that affect your sex life? How does that affect trauma responses in people? How does that affect how I behave? Oh, shame. Shame's a huge thing. Okay, how do you deal with shame around sexual abuse and the feelings and emotions and sensations your body physically held on that? Oh, interesting. Okay, what shuts off? What doesn't? Like, this is kind of how I started. And I did everything from faith-based to not, to, you know, beating up trees in a forest. Like, I did everything and anything to try it and just started testing my own brain. So because I had so many different specific traumas, it'd be like, okay, this one, how does this affect this? How does A affect B affect C affect D? Okay, so if you tweak this here and adjust this here and connect those dots, how can we get a different result at the end? And just started working my way through that and being really open to like no judgment, just let's get curious what's actually going on.
So you didn't really have anybody else you were working with?
At that point, no. I had sat in my, I don't even know how many psychologists I work with and therapists, and I love them. I'm not saying that they're bad. Just, it wasn't working for me. It wasn't working for my brain. And I sat in one's office one time and I said, look, I need you to tell me what to do. And she looked at me kind of funny and she went, what do you mean? I said, I need you to tell me I'm going to be okay. I need you to tell me when I need to wake up in the morning and what music I need to listen to and that I need to shower and brush my teeth. And if I need to stand like a flamingo and I need to eat grapefruits all day and I need to, like, I need you to literally tell me what to do to start this pathway of healing. And she looked at me and just with tears in her eyes, she was like, I can't. And I was like, then why are you here? I need that kind of direction. I need someone who has a strategy going, look, you're here and then we're going to do these things and we're going to get you here. And then you're going to like do this and then we're going to move forward and backwards. And right. And this is how this journey is going to go, but we're going to get you where you want to go. And I'm going to fight to the death for you. And they couldn't. And that's the kind of healing I needed. I needed it at a different pace. I needed someone who would push me. I needed someone who would call me on my crap. And I mean, maybe they're out there, but I couldn't find them.
So do you just do it yourself? You just come up with your own plan? And how do you motivate yourself?
I did.
When you're in that state?
You know, my biggest thing is life is too damn short to suffer and I'm stuck with me for the rest of my life. So do I still want to be this person? And the thought of that is motivation enough in a lot of ways. And one of the biggest things I do is, and I say this to clients all the time, is like, get out of bed and start with a shower. And one of the things I often say is like, put on some damn pants, like get out of your pajamas, put on some real clothes, start there. You just had a giant win day two. Right. But also like audit your life. So what music are you listening to? What books are you reading? Are you listening to the news all the time? Are you surrounding yourself with garbage? Start to look at yourself like, no, no, no. I'm going to mama bear protect myself, my emotional state, and anything and everything that comes into my space, into my body, into my brain is going to be amazing. And it's one tiny degree at a time, just one tiny step at a time. Just, and then all of a sudden you get traction and you just go.
It's just baby steps, basically. Take the win.
Totally.
Don't get discouraged about it and take the win.
Yeah. And sometimes that's as much, like sometimes you literally like, I got up and I put on pants and then I laid on the couch and I'm going to watch TV all day because that's about as much as I could do, but I'm wearing pants. Right. And that's as far as you can go with it some days because you are so dark and you are so far down, you don't know what to do. Right.
Yeah.
Maybe the next day you get up and you shower and you put on pants and then you're like, I'm going to put on mascara. Today I'm going to do something to make me feel better about myself. Right. And sometimes it's that slow. Sometimes it's those tiny baby steps of like, all right, I did that. Now what? But you need an action plan. You can't just count on your feelings to be like, I'm going to magically wake up tomorrow and everything's going to be great.
How long does it take you to get to where you felt like you were getting ahead? Or are you still working on it?
There was so much to deal with. I don't think we ever stopped working. It's different now. Now isn't about the big traumas. Now isn't about like, now I have to deal with the aftermath of not being a mom and not being able to have kids or infertility or what does that look like? Now it's the little trauma responses that come along the journey. Now it's the little stuff where it's like, oh, I reacted really strongly to something this week. What's going on? Right? Or little things like our final sibling between my husband and I just had a baby. And there was a shift from there's a bunch of us without kids to now we're the only ones without kids. So that was an emotional shift that I had to deal with. And there was a small piece of almost grieving again that I had to go through to process that. But a big part of that is allow yourself to actually feel your emotions. If you're angry, be angry. If you're sad, be sad. don't be like, no, you're not allowed to feel that because you should be okay. You've dealt with this forever. Actually allow yourself to feel those emotions. And so I have a rage room in my house. I have an area where people can go in my office to release emotion, to rage, to let it all out, or to just cry. I use it. And now it's going, no, I have the skills. I have the tools. I have what it takes to get through anything and everything that comes my way. It's not like you heal and all of a sudden you're like, okay, cool. Life's going to be perfect from now on and nothing's going to happen because we're dealing with humans.
And everybody kind of reacts differently to it.
100%.
How are you able to help others get over their trauma when you have your trauma still? Do you ever get set off or triggered and then it's harder to help them?
Very seldom these days. Very seldom these days. I think part of it is that I had healed to such a big degree before I was willing to talk to anyone and help them, because I knew that if I was being triggered by their trauma, I was now sitting in their trauma with them. How do you pull them out of it? How do you guide them out when you're in the hole with them? And so I'm very careful in how I work my schedule and how I schedule people. Obviously, I don't want like 9 back-to-back sexual abuse clients in a day, because at some point, it's almost like my resiliency wears down and I start to just feel more, right? But I mean, Sarah, working through all of your stuff, did you ever feel like you were setting me back or I was in your trauma with you?
No, but I did feel like you understood. And there's a big difference between that, because I didn't feel like I had to take care of you. There have been other people I've worked with in the past where you can kind of tell, even though I don't know how to explain it, even though they weren't as vulnerable and open about what they had been through, like you could kind of tell when they start to get upset and then you start worrying about caretaking for them. But with Donna, I always felt like she could take care of her own stuff and I didn't have to worry about her. So I could tell her what I needed to tell her, but I still feel like she understood, which is a huge difference.
I can imagine that makes all the difference. Yeah.
Well, and I know there have been times where I'm like, oh, hey, I just had this crazy trauma response happen. Let me walk you through how I'm now dealing with this, how I'm processing this. And that's a vulnerability that I do have with my clients, to show them like, hey, these are tools you can use for the rest of your life. These are skills you're developing for the rest of your life. But let me walk you through this in real time. And there have been times where I included Sarah in some pretty crazy trauma response stuff where I was like, be what this actually looks like. Walk through this. And that was something that I always felt was missing personally, was, you know, years of doing this, I would try to find someone who got it or someone who had lived through it. And it was, you'd find all these books or hear all these speakers. It was like, my life was horrible. Now it's amazing. You can do it too. And it was like, no, where are the missing steps in the middle? I want to know about when you like hit hell again. I want to know like, how you dug yourself out of that. I want to know what a day in depression looks like for you. I want to know these things so I can see myself in you to have hope that I can get there one day. So I do often include my clients when something triggers, and it's not often. Like these days, it's very seldom I do get triggered, but I can include clients in that to go, hey, this is what happened. This is how it triggered me. This is what's going on. This is how I'm processing it. I think that's made a big difference for clients.
Oh, I bet. But that's got to be hard. Did it take a while for you to be able to open up to clients when you're seeing them? Or was that something you were able to do right away?
Right away. That was a thing when I was, oh man, how old was I? It was after the sexual abuse. And I had already dealt with quite a bit prior to the sexual abuse. And I was crying in a bed at a camp with my best friend. And I said to her, I was like, I have to figure out a way to help someone with this one day, or to like use this in a good way, or else I can't, like, I can't do this. And that always kind of became my motto, is like, how do I use this to help somebody else? So my whole life, I have just taught, like, I've gotten in trouble for how vulnerable I've been and how open I've been. But I wish someone else had been that way with me. I wish someone had come to me and been like, you know what? I've been there. I've been exactly where you are. I'm just like 30 steps ahead of you. Have hope. This is some of the stuff you're probably going to deal with. This is some of the stuff you're going to have to process and work through, but you can do it too. But everyone's quiet. No one talks about it. And no one talks about the journey, right? So that's something where I very early just was like, here I am. This is what I'm going through. I'm going to just share it with the world. And it's never not scary to share that. Right? Because as soon as you're that vulnerable, people can take it and they can do with it what they want. But I always said, if this helps one person heal, every ounce of pain I've lived through is worth it. That's been my line for as long as I can remember.
Right. That's That's a good point. That's got to be extremely vulnerable for like both of you saying it. Has anybody, mm-hmm. I mean, other than when you told your parents and when Sarah told her church leaders, is there other people that use it against you?
Oh, all the time.
All the time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It triggers people though, right? People are very uncomfortable with the fact that I am so comfortable with it and I am so willing to talk about it and I'm willing to open up about it. It makes people really uncomfortable because they might not be comfortable enough. And we live in a society that always makes people feel less than. Yeah. Or they remember things different or they're ashamed of how they behaved in the situation. I've gotten a lot of that. Where a lot of the flack I get from people or the negativity I get from people is based on their behaviors around what happened. Right. So it's like, you need to shut up, Dawn, because we behaved really bad. And you talking about this is reminding us of how bad we've behaved. That's a big one.
Yeah, that is. I know. I'm trying to process that. How do you handle that situation when you find yourself in it, when someone is trying to bring you down with it?
I'm really big on knowing it's not about me. It has nothing to do with me. It's my story. It happened to me. If I want to scream it from the mountaintops, that's up to me. Right. And the only way I can't make anyone feel a feel, right? You can't make anybody actually feel something. And so if something I did or said is causing you upset, you're choosing to be upset over it. What it shows me is their fear in the situation. It's really just shining a light on their fear, on their shame, on something that they're scared of in their own life. And so I really I really picture myself outside of the situation where it's like, wow, you're really hurt and you just need someone safe to like dump that on. You can bring it. Bring me all your pain. It's okay. Say what you need to say. And then I'm still going to talk. Right. Not going to change it.
What do you think is the most important step? Is it talking about what happened?
Getting a person to where they believe they're not going to hurt me by talking is huge. Because when we've lived through the trauma we've lived through, and when you tell people and they like go, oh, right? Or they like gasp or they react strongly or they can't handle what you're saying. You're like, great, now I've hurt you too. And so we hold all that shame. So getting a person to the point where it's like, No. I see you. I hear you. I've got you. I promise you're not going to break and you're not going to hurt me if you talk is the biggest.
Okay.
That is the absolute biggest. And as soon as they talk, as soon as they start actually saying things, it's amazing how it's like this weight comes off their shoulders where they're like, somebody knows and they still love me. Somebody knows and I didn't hurt them.
Right.
Somebody knows and they're not going to like sell it to the media or hold this over my head or go tell anybody.
Yeah.
And when there's no judgment where I'm like, yeah, that really sucks. Let's talk about it. It's getting them to that point and then convincing them they're actually worth fighting for to go through it.
It's kind of like, Mike, when I told you that, you know, Dawn and I had that session where I told her over the 3.5 hours, right, everything that had happened to me when I was little. And I woke up the next day and I was like, oh, like, okay. It's like, I'm okay. I got through it. She got through it. We got through it. Like, we walked together through it. Right. I'm okay. I'm all right. Right. And it's like that huge weight got lifted.
Okay, how deep into the sessions was that? Was that the first one?
Oh, no.
Nope.
No. Because we had to build up trust,
right?
Trust
first.
Yeah. Right. So it was, we've been working together, I think a couple months before we did that. And we had actually planned a couple months into it to do that session. And then we got closer to it. And Dawn basically said, she probably said a lot more eloquently than what I'm going to say it, right? But basically said, like, we're not at the point where there's enough trust yet between the two of us. She was like, do you feel like you want to tell me? But she said, I want us to have an even healthier, like more trusting relationship before you do that point. And so then I think it was another, I don't know, month or so of us working together before we actually had that session, which at the time I was mad about, right? I get mad at her a
real
lot. So
mad.
I was mad about it.
Real
but
mad.
I was also like, oh, she's keeping me safe. She's not telling me that it's my fault. She's not telling me that I'm never going to get there. She's not telling me we're never going to do it. She's just telling me like, hey, like, let's hold off a little bit and like spend more time together before you actually do that, which was really wise looking back because that trust factor is so, so huge.
Yeah.
At that point, I knew that you were so desperate to finally tell your whole story. And because we had talked about it and you kept wanting to, and I was like, no, you don't trust me yet. So you're going to give me the story that everybody else gives you. Or that you give everybody else, you're going to give me like this surface level of it. Not yet, not yet, not yet. right? And you were so mad at me. And I was like, but when it's time, it's going to be perfect. And I'll know the moment when it's like, okay, you actually trust me enough that I can push you on this and you're going to trust me to be able to hold you through this and carry you through this, knowing it wasn't going to be a 45 minute or an hour session, right? Like, I think I had blocked 5 hours in my schedule for that night, knowing that it was going to take a while. Because it was like, no, if you don't trust me, you're not going to trust me to push you deeper. You're not going to trust me to pull you out of it. You're not going to trust me to do that. So you're going to be so caught up in like, how do I protect myself through this? Because I don't actually trust you to take care of me in this. And that was the biggest part.
So when someone comes to you, that's the hardest part, is building up that trust for them to let you in, right?
Yeah. And my vulnerability helps so much with that.
Right.
When I can be vulnerable and someone can know some of my story and actually see that, they're like, oh, okay, yeah, you've actually been here. You're not just this random person going, hi, how are you? Tell me what's happened to you, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, let's do this. Let's dig. And because I've also been there, I can see at what point it's like, no, we need to pull this back a little bit. Or no, I need to dig deeper because you're withholding. And there's something deeper that we need to dig into, right? It's playing that game.
You block out 5 hours. Is that typically the length?
I did with Sarah.
So is that not a typical session when someone's going to break everything down for you?
No, everybody is totally different.
Right.
Some people need an hour. My longest coaching session to date was 17 hours.
Continuously?
One session. Yeah. Wow. And it's 100% based on the person, how they talk, how they process, how quick they can go into it, how trusting they are with me at that point. There's a lot that goes into how long I block into my calendar when someone finally talks.
Yeah. So when Sarah comes in, because it sounds like she was in a horrible place when she came to see you, she was on a ton of meds. So what's your, I guess, do you develop a game plan when she first comes in? And this is completely how comfortable you guys feel about talking about this, by the way.
So it's interesting. When I got introduced to Dawn, it was through a mutual friend of ours. And so Dawn's actually written a book about her life. And so I, at some point, would like to write a book about my life. And so our mutual friend said, you should meet this woman. Our mutual friend knew a little bit about me, right? So you should meet this woman. You guys can probably relate. And she's written a book. And so she can talk to you about writing a book. So Dawn very kindly was like, yeah, sure, I'll talk to you for free about this book thing, right? And so Dawn, out of the blue,
brain.
Right, yeah, she's, you can pick my brain, it's fine. So we get on Zoom and I'm talking to her and she's talking my language. And there's not a lot of people, Mike, that ever talk my language.
Yeah.
And I said, this is weird. And I, as miserable and horrible as I was, I thought that was really the best my life was going to get. I mean, I really thought, I was like, this is the best my life's ever going to get, right? And I made a comment at one point. Dawn had kind of said, Sasha, I'd be willing to work with you or coach you through some of this if you'd ever like. I was like, oh no, it's okay. Like, I'm all right. And I remember the look on her face was like,
right.
And I was like, oh, maybe this woman knows something I don't know about life, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought about it, and like within 24 hours, I was like, okay, what does this cause? What does coaching look like? What do we need to do, right, to get this plan together? So I say that to say, like, it's interesting because my life is so night and day different, and I was so miserable and on so many meds and having such a hard time functioning. But because I was told, like, there's nothing else we can do for you, I was also like, oh, this is the best my life's going to get. Like, okay, this is what I got to keep dealing with. And so, anyway, sorry, Dawn, go ahead.
No. And it was really funny because in that conversation, we were talking and I said, you know, the hardest part about putting out a book, if you're going to be vulnerable and tell your story, is the fact that when you put it out there, you have no control over what happens to it. You don't know how someone's going to take it, if they're going to rip it apart, if they're going to splash it all over somewhere, if they're going to like attack or disown you. Like, you have no idea. Like, you have no idea what's going to happen, and you can't be there to control their emotional response to what they're reading. And I said, so that is something that A, you have to deal with. But I said, the second thing, like B, you got to deal with the fact that now everyone who reads it is coming to you and wanting to talk about it. So are you comfortable reliving your trauma every single time someone's like, hey, I was raped too, can we talk about how you dealt with that? And you're like, yeah, sure. let's dig into this for the 700th time this year, right?
Yeah.
And Sarah was like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm like, cool, tell me about your story. And she was like, no. And like, she's ruffled. And I was like, no, tell me what happened and tell me how he did it and tell me all this stuff. And like, I started to like dig and push a little bit. And she was like, well, and I was like, you're not ready. Like, if you can't even tell me safely on a Zoom as a stranger, how are you going to put this in a book and set that out there and be like, no, it's okay. Talk to me about this. That was where I was like, we should, interested. We could talk about this.
Right.
That's kind of where that started. And then I laughed and I got the email going, yeah, maybe we should talk.
I never thought about that. Did you know that going in? You probably didn't know that.
For myself or for Sarah?
When you wrote your book.
Oh, I knew that that's what was going to happen. And that was like in how vulnerable I wrote my book and in how raw and real it was. I asked my siblings in advance. I was like, heads up, I'm going to write a book about my life. But that also means that your childhood is somewhat going to be a part of this, right? Because mom and dad are going to be part of it. And the toxicity of everything that went down and some of my traumas, right? And they were like, yeah, whatever, write a book. I don't actually think they believed I would write a book. And so then when it was done, I was like, oh no, it's being published and it's coming out in like 3 months. They were like, oh, you actually wrote a book. And so, but I knew that in advance, as I really had to weigh that of by writing this, I'm going to hurt people. There are people in my life that are going to feel hurt. They're going to be upset, whether because they knew me and now they're realizing they didn't really know me, or because there's things in their childhood that are being exposed because of it. There were all these parts and pieces to it that I had to look at and go, this is going to suck really bad. And I'm going to have some really angry people at me, but it's also going to help people. So I had things like, you know, I had a really brutal relationship with my mom, and I printed that chapter and showed it to some clients that had issues with their moms. And I was like, can you just read this and give me feedback? And they were, when they were calling me crying and being like, tell me this is going in your book. This is so powerful. I was like, okay. But then I would send it to like my childhood best friend. And she's like, oh girl, you can't write that. You can't, like, that's going to destroy your mom's sisters and her parents. And because my mom had passed away at this point. And so I was like, okay, how do I tweak this? How do I make it less aggressive against her, or shift it so that it doesn't hurt as bad while still keeping the message of what I'm saying? So yeah, I had dealt with that. And the aftermath of having written the book, of people walking out of my life because they couldn't handle what I'd been through, that were uncomfortable with my story, people that were just really angry that I was spilling the family secrets, right? I had had to deal with that already. And I knew that going in. So now every time I talk to someone who's writing a book about their personal life, I'm like, just a heads up.
It's gonna
like, this
be rough.
Is kind of what goes with, this is what goes with writing a book. It's not as innocent as you might think.
Yeah. I never even thought about that, but it's so obvious as you're explaining it. So you've lost people from your life when you published the book.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Have they come back into your life?
Mm-mm.
They're that mad?
Yeah.
Is it people that were in the book or other people?
Hilariously, no, not people in the book.
Really?
People that all of a sudden couldn't look at me the same way. There's this weird, I don't even know how I word it. There's this weird thing of like, oh, you've been damaged. You've been broken. Do I know how to deal with you? Right? Or like, your story is too big for me. You're too much. I was always told, like, you're just so much. So much has happened. You're too much. Like, that was a really big theme in my life. And so people read it and very like, oh, you've had an interesting life. Mm-hmm. And then this weird separation. Yeah. And some people that just became really awkward. And some of them have turned around and it's just, it's more normal now. But oh yeah, lots of people. And lots of people that still believe that you should never talk about what's happened to you, right? There's so many people of older generations, especially, that really believe that you need to like shut up, forgive and forget, and act like nothing happened. And we don't air the public laundry, right? Like we don't do that. And so then in talking about things and writing about things, you know, I was raised very Mennonite. I wrote about that and my experience in it. And I had like cousins contacting me being like, how dare you? And I'm like, did I write anything that was a lie? And they were like, well, no. And I'm like, then why is this an issue? Right? Well, it's no one's business how our family was when we were growing up. And so there was, there was interesting. Oh, just oh, we're mad.
Right. Were any of them mad that you didn't tell them before?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one of the biggest things is I became the ultimate secret keeper. So even though I was dealing with a lot of stuff and I had a lot of mayhem and chaos going on in my life, I didn't talk to people about it. So I had big situations where I know my brother called me after he read it and he's like, okay, so either I'm the world's worst brother or you are the greatest secret keeper on the planet. Because how did I not know the majority of this? And I was like, nah, 50-50. Right? Like, yeah. We'll both take some blame on that. But that's probably where most people were the most angry, was the fact that I hadn't shared with them what I'd been going through and what I'd been living through.
Do you just have one sibling?
Older sister, younger brother.
Did they not have the same experience you did growing up?
Not at all. No, not at all.
So this was probably pretty shocking to them. Are they still in your
parts
life?
Parts of it, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Did they know it before the book? Obviously your brother didn't, but did your sister?
She knew more, but it triggered some trauma for her as well when she read my book and even like thinking about it coming out. And like, she had no idea what had all gone down around the sexual abuse. She had no idea about all the suicide attempts. She had no idea how severe like my drug addiction prior to my hysterectomy was. Like, there were all these parts and pieces that she's just like, I had no idea I was that bad. Wow. Right. But then that also creates an interesting, like, don't you love me? Didn't you trust me? Why didn't you include me in your life? Which then wrapped around to this feeling of like, but you weren't safe. You didn't get it. And I didn't want to hurt you. I didn't want to drag you into this. So I just kept it a secret to protect you. And I think that's so much of it is, there, tell me if I'm wrong, but sometimes it's like, I don't want to tell people things. I don't want them to know, because it's like, oh, great. Now they're thinking about this and they're having to deal with this. And, you know, I know that, you know, someone said to me a while ago or years ago, they're like, really, is sexual abuse that big of a deal? Like, once it's done, it's kind of done and it's not a big issue. And other than wanting to punch them, I was like, you know what, let me point out, and this is a relative. And I was like, let me just tell you one piece of sexual abuse that probably causes the most issues. And they were like, what's that? And I said, you know, those nerve endings, the ones that cause you orgasms and like cause you to have real good feels in sex. And they were like, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, those nerves don't shut off when you're being raped and abused. I said, so you're feeling good and bad at the same time. And now there's this weird shame attached to it and these weird emotions. And then you gaslight yourself going, did I want it? Did I enjoy it? Did I ask for it? And there's like this chaos in your head. I was like, try being in a healthy marriage or in a healthy relationship after that. And his jaw hit the floor. And he was like, oh, I was like, yeah, that. Dang. Right.
Yeah.
But that relationship shifted after that, because all of a sudden it was like, oh, she's too much. Like, we're not going to go there.
Oh, wow. Even after explaining it, he didn't. It was just too much for him.
People don't want to face their own demons.
People have a hard time sometimes, Mike, with authenticity, right? People have a hard time when you're vulnerable and honest, right? Because then one, it makes them look at themselves. And two, people struggle with it.
I bet.
They do, because they're burying their own garbage. And what you say triggers them. And now they might actually have to face it, or face a bias that they have, or face a behavior that they've had, or face, you know, thoughts that they've had in a way that they maybe have hurt someone else in their life too. Right? When you shine a light on someone's crap, they don't always like it.
Yeah.
Is that the understatement of the day, Sarah?
I'm going to say they always don't like it.
No.
So what do you think? So if there's someone out there right now experiencing something like this, what's the best piece of advice that both of you could give them?
So my piece of advice would be to focus on whatever little good nuggets that you can find in your life, truly, whatever little things that you can find of to be grateful for, to be thankful for, to find some good in your life, to focus on that. And then my second piece of advice, because I'm biased, would be to reach out to Dawn, right? And or whoever it is that you can actually find who understands where you've been and can help you work through it, right? A professional who can actually help you get, because so many, I don't know, there's so many people who care, who are professionals, who are wonderful, but they don't actually get it and don't actually have the strategy, right, to get from A to B to C down the road. And so, you know, I obviously suggest reaching out to Dawn, but in addition, find that right person for you, right, that'll get you from A to B. And it's okay to ask for help, and that no matter what anybody tells you, you're not too much, and you deserve to heal, right? You deserve the help.
It's not your fault.
It is not your fault.
Yeah. I think like, it's not your fault. You are worth fighting for. You are 100% worth fighting for, and it's never too late, right? If what you're doing isn't working, shift, try something different, get another opinion, interview another therapist, put a post out on social media going, hey, this is what I'm looking for. This is who I want to talk to help. You don't have to sit stagnant in what you're doing. Like, keep going. And I think that's one of the biggest is, like, if one strategy isn't working, find another one.
Take the little wins, right? Like you said. Yeah, find a new one that you can get those little wins, basically.
Totally. But also, like, if one doctor isn't working for you, if you've been seeing the same psychologist for 15 years and you are still in the same spot you were in 15 years ago, fire them and hire another one, right? Like, don't just sit there and go, but this is what my life has to be. Don't buy into that lie that is being spoken over you.
That's good.
Because it can get better. And it's one extra thing. And people fight so hard for themselves. And I know, Sarah, you and I've had this conversation, right? Like, you were fighting so hard and it just took one more person, one more program, one more course, one more coach before you found the person who could help you get where you wanted to go and are continuing to go, right?
That's the thing. People don't always understand. Like, I worked so hard for myself. I did, but I didn't have the right, I didn't have the right guide, right? I didn't have the right person to get me to where I needed to go or to help me understand how to get where I needed to go. It was never that I didn't want to feel better. It was never that I didn't want to heal. It was never that I wasn't willing to work towards it. I couldn't get the traction to get to where I needed to be.
Yeah. And that's where, like, you don't have to stay where you are. If it's not working, find someone else. Continue to fight. Get scrappy about it. Get so scrappy about it.
Fight for yourself. Getting to that point where you can fight for yourself.
And if you can't, find someone in your life who loves you enough that they will fight for you. And they will go interview coaches and they will interview therapists and they will do that for you.
Yeah.
You don't have to do it on your own.
Yeah. How can people get in contact with you if they need your help?
For sure. So my email is hello@thetaylorway.ca. My website is thetaylorway.ca, or I have a healing home as well where people can come to do, like, immersion style healing, like a retreat style. And so that email or that website is seenheardhealed.com. Sarah, is there anywhere else that I should mention?
I think those are the best places. You're on Facebook and Instagram too, right? But yeah.
I'll try to link or tag or whatever it is on Facebook. I'm not great at it, but I will do my best at getting the information on there with the episode. Is there anything else that we missed that we want to cover real quick?
Not for me, other than, you know, thanks, Micah. I appreciate, you know, you having me on and, you know, obviously having Dawn on to talk about it, because I think it's important for people to know you can have those kind of life experiences and still have a life of joy, you know, and get to this point. So I appreciate you having us on.
There is so much beauty on the other side of your pain, like, so much.
Yeah. Ladies, I thank you so much. I know this was hard for both of you. I know it was hard for me just to hear it. So I completely get it.
Be calling me going, how do I process this?
That's right. Oh, that was good. Well, I guess that's a perfect place to end it right there. So thank you so much for sharing your story with me.
There is a rock star.
Thank you. We'll see you guys next time.
Talk to you later.